Welcome to Tuesday's edition of Financial Survival, sponsored by Discount Gold and Silver Trading. I'm Dave Allen. Two different things today. First, I'm just getting over a case of laryngitis, so please excuse my scratchy, nasally voice. Second, and much more important, I'm so pleased to welcome to today's program a fellow DGS Coins groupie, Mary Ellen, who will be sitting in for Melody. This is Mary Ellen's first venture on the air with us, so please, please join me in welcoming her to Financial Survival. Hello, Mary Ellen.
Hello, Dave. Thank you, and listeners.
Yay, great to have you with us. For all your gold and silver needs, call us toll-free at 1-800-375-4188. That's 800-375-4188. Customers may, pardon me, I'm going to have a lot of that, I'm afraid, on today's program. Customers may recognize Mary Ellen's voice as one of the folks who answers the line to take your gold and silver questions and orders. So anyway, for the next hour, Mary Ellen and I will be bringing you our opinions and commentary on the economic and political news of the day. Today is Tuesday, June 15th, 2021. Hey, thanks in advance to our producer and engineer, Todd. Let's get started with the market report. Rather blasé day in the precious metals markets. Gold continued a new slide, closing down $7 in the New York after spot market at 1859.90. Silver down 17 cents to 27.76. Platinum down 12 at 11.59. Palladium, I'm really sorry, ladies and gentlemen. Palladium up 13 at 28.46. In the various paper markets, looking at bonds, the 10-year Treasury yield down 0.005, fairly flat in the day, closing at 1.496%. The 5-year down 0.003. closing at 0.784. The 30-year up slightly at 2.193. All indicating that when you count in inflation, particularly at the last 2 months rates, we are in negative yield territory, just like our European peers. Not surprisingly, well, you know, the U.S. dollar index actually was unchanged today at 90.52. Oil, crude oil, up $1.35 to 72.23 per barrel. And in the stock markets internationally, results were mixed, some up, some down. Here in the U.S., the Dow Jones closed down 94.42 at 34,299. The broader S&P 500 down 8.5 to close at 42.46 and change. And the NASDAQ down 101 to close at just under 14,000. 73. Unsurprisingly, the VIX volatility index jumped up about 4% today. It's at 17, roughly, as we speak. And that, ladies and gentlemen, is today's DGS Coins Market Report, brought to you by Discount Gold and Silver Trading. Let's get to some news, Mary Ellen.
Okay. Producer prices rise more than expected. Prices paid to U.S. producers rose more than expected in May, fueling companies to raise prices on American customers. The producer price index for final demand increased 0.8% from the prior month after a 0.6% gain in April. According to the Labor Department this morning, excluding volatile food and energy components, the so-called core PPI rose 0.7%. A survey of economists called for a 0.5% monthly gain in the overall measure and the same advance in the core figure. The PPI, which tracks changes in production cost, has surged in recent months. Elevated materials prices and shortages paired with shipping bottlenecks and rising labor expenses have enlarged production cost. Meantime, a burst of pent-up customer demand has outstripped the capacity, stoking further price gains. Federal Reserve officers have said the upward pressure on prices will likely prove temporary, but others worry recent price gains will lead to a more sustained pickup in inflation. Data out of last week signaled that businesses are successfully passing along at least some of the burden of higher costs to consumers.
Yeah, you know, we'll be talking more about this subject later in the program. The CPI advanced, we know, more than expected for a third straight month in May, extending that months-long buildup in inflation. The annualized advance in the overall PPI rose to a 6.6% gain. That's a figure biased higher by the fact that it was compared to the soft reading seen in May last year, in the midst of the raging pandemic. But the increase was the largest in data going back to 2010. Now, almost 60% of the May increase in the index for final demand can be traced to a 1.5% advance in prices of goods. The costs of non-ferrous metals, motor vehicles, and beef, plus fuel, all climbed. Prices for services rose for a fifth straight month, with more than 40% of the increase attributable to automobile retailing margins, which surged over 27%. Producer prices, excluding food, energy, and trade services, that's the measure often preferred by economists because it strips out the most volatile components, advanced 0.7% from the prior month and rose 5.3% year over year. I don't know about you, Mary Ellen. I think these volatile component numbers are bogus, and I think it's just another way for government agencies to make the numbers look just a little bit better than they really are. Anyway, what's next?
Well, retail sales declined in May. Retails, after the stimulus-related splurge in the prior 2 months, suggesting customers are starting to shift more of their spending to services as the economy reopens. Total value of the retail purchases fell 1.3% in May, following an upward revised 0.9% gain in April. Commerce Department's figures showed that today. Median estimate in a survey of economists called for a 0.8% decrease. For the past year, demand for goods has been propped up by elevated savings supported by fiscal stimulus, bringing total retail sales well above pre-pandemic levels. The May decline in retail sales suggests as travel picks up and entertainment ventures reopen, spending on goods is starting to moderate. The total value of the retail sales was $622.2 $1.2 billion in May, well above the $527 billion in February of 2020, before the pandemic. The sales data precedes today's conclusion of the Fed's two-day policy meeting. Investors and economists will be watching to see whether the Fed adjusts its outlook for scaling back monetary support as price pressures build and areas of the economy, like consumer spending, improve more quickly than expected. While the spending is experienced to continue strengthening, the pace will probably moderate as enhanced unemployment benefits expire and stimulus checks are spent.
Yeah, that's the end of those benefits is coming sooner and sooner, ending in September. Now, here we are, the big I word again, inflation, a sustained pickup of that may also cause consumers to limit their discretionary expenditures. A separate report last week showed that prices paid by consumers rose in May by more than forecast. Economists now estimate a robust pace of overall household outlays in the second quarter before slowing down in the second half of the year. Retail sales in the 3 months through May have increased at a 57% annualized rate. 8 of the 13 major retail categories posted declines in sales receipts last month. And excluding vehicle sales, all retail sales decreased by 0.7% in May. Motor vehicle and parts dealer sales fell 3.7%. Furniture stores, electronic outlets, and building material merchants also posted declines. Restaurant sales rose 1.8%. Actually surprised it's not up more, underscoring consumer shift toward services spending as social distancing restrictions ease and health concerns decline. Perhaps that lower than expected restaurant number may deal from that industry's difficulty in recruiting workers back to their former places of employment. Now, the retail sales don't include figures on other service categories like travel and accommodation. Sales of clothing stores rebounded 3%. So-called control group sales, which exclude more volatile categories, again, like food services, car dealers, and gasoline stations, fell another 0.7% after a 0.4% decrease in April. Mary Ellen.
Okay. Home builders' sentiment in June fell to its lowest level since last August as construction costs pushed new home prices higher, sidelining buyers and making it harder for some builders to get loans. The National Association of Home Builders Housing Market Index dropped 2 points to 81, down from a recent record peak of 90 last November. Anything above 50 is still considered positive, so you got to think that things are looking up. And AHB Chair Chuck Folk said these higher costs have moved some new homes beyond the budget of prospective buyers, which has slowed the strong pace of home building. While lumber prices are down about 10% from the recent peak, they're still about 300% higher than the 15-year average. Costs for other building products are also higher, and deliveries are still delayed, all due to the lingering supply chain issues from the pandemic. These higher costs are being passed on to buyers. The median price of a newly built home in April, the most recent reading, was up 20% year over year, according to the Census Bureau.
Wow. Not only is that pricing buyers out, Mary Ellen, but it's causing appraisal issues for particularly the smaller builders who make up two-thirds of the home building market. the NAHB's chief economist, Bob Dietz, said you need an appraisal to get the bank loan. But the appraisal for the eventual home sale price comes in lower than your cost because appraisals have tended to lag where market prices and construction costs are. That means you either need more equity or you can't proceed with the loan. I can see how that's a potential problem. Of the sentiment's three components, current sales conditions fell 2 points to 86. Sales conditions for the next 6 months, expectations, dropped 2% to 79. And buyer traffic was also down 2 points to 71. That is actually the lowest of the components. Regionally, on a three-month moving average, sentiment in the South rose 1.85, fell a point to 89 in the West, dropped 3 points to 72 in the Midwest, and in the Northeast fell 5 points to 78. A lot of numbers, ladies and gentlemen. Hope you're paying attention out there.
Absolutely,
Mary Ellen, what's
Dave.
Next?
We know that one big reason why so many policymakers are not panicking about inflation is that the world economies are still short so many millions of jobs. The global employment shortfall from the pandemic is predicted by the International Labor Organization to be over 75 million this year, nor does it expect the gap to be closed by 2022, when it believes the world will still be 23 million jobs short of its pre-COVID path, even as economies rebound. The Organization of Economic Cooperation and Development echoes the warning, saying unemployment will remain above pre-crisis levels in many countries this year. With so many workers still on the sidelines, it should be harder for those in employment to push for big pay increases. It's even that even though the cost of living is rising fast in much of the world, as supply bottlenecks and surging demand accompany the great reopening from lockdown, doesn't mean nobody gets a raise. Wages have been climbing in the U.S. and other countries, especially in industries that are pushing to staff up again after the customers return. Sounds
hey,
good?
Hey, perfect timing. That music means it's time for a short break.
Super.
Stick around as we listen to these messages. You're listening to Financial Survival. We will find you right.
Since the beginning of the United States, kings have sought it, nations have fought for it. It has been traded, borrowed, purchased, and stolen. There is a reason for it. To secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity, invest with the security of gold and silver. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading at 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Listen to Financial Survival with your host, Melody Cederstrom, on Shortwave Radio. Visit DiscountGoldAndSilverTrading.net or call 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. For the very best in gold and silver trading, call toll-free 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Call now.
Melody Cederstrom and CSE Talk Radio team up as Common Sense Voices of Integrity. I personally endorse Melody Cederstrom to be your trusted go-to expert for all your precious metal needs. Experts agree a financial crisis and even collapse is inevitable. Given our government's lack of economic leadership and self-interests of those in power, it's no longer a question of if you should purchase gold and silver, but if you will purchase gold and silver before it's too late. Melody encourages you to tune in each weekday morning. Visit CSE Talk Radio. TimUpRadio.com. We both agree truth and education are the two significant factors in both our missions. There is a wealth of misinformation out there. Let Melody and Beth Ann help you sort through the chaos and bring you home to the truths that will ensure that you and your family are protected. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading, 1-800-375-4188, or online at DGScoins.com. Melody and Beth Ann are strong forces together, working to preserve liberty and bring America home.
Hey, welcome back to Financial Survival, brought to you by Discount Gold and Silver Trading. I'm Dave Allen, here with our special guest host, Mary Ellen, sitting in for Melody today. Well, where to start the second segment? I think this story, we like to talk about the inequities in income and pay that we've seen that have certainly been exacerbated by the pandemic. We certainly don't begrudge anyone making their fair share. We're seeing in this latest level today in the healthcare industry that CEO pay is up a whopping 31% since before the pandemic. Mary Ellen, you want to take that away?
Sure. CEOs of 178 healthcare companies collectively made $3.2 billion during the pandemic, which was 31% more than 2019. That's according to the new Axios analysis of financial filings. Healthcare executives took home more than ever because a vast majority of their pay still comes in the form of stock. So while COVID ravaged people's lives, the healthcare system and the broader economy, the soaring stock market immunized executives' pay. The median pay for a healthcare CEO in 2020 was more than $9 million, up from 2018 and 2019. 30 CEOs made more than $30 million each. The highest paid healthcare CEO 2020 was Joe Kneed of a large medical device company best known for its products that measure oxygen, saturation, and other vitals. Kneed earned more than $210 million last year.
Oh, it's good to be king.
How about that? The highest amount of any healthcare CEO in the past 3 years we've studied, and an amount equal to 88% of Masimo's net profit in 2020. Their sales increased by 22% last year to $1.1 billion, and the stock's price jumped almost 70%. More hospitals bought the company's patient monitoring devices to treat the influx of COVID-19 patients.
This is interesting, Mary Ellen, in a couple of respects. My mother, who suffers from COPD, actually just came home from, she got transferred from a hospital to a nursing home for some rehab, but she has at home one of Masimo's, I forget what the device is called, but it's the one that measures oxygen saturation, as the name right there, right on the front. So that's fascinating. I'll have to tell her about this when I see her this weekend. Now, two other executives surpassed the 100 million pay mark last year. Leonard Schleifer of Regeneron Pharmaceuticals, which made a COVID treatment, and Paul Cussero of Amedisys, that's a home health and hospice company. the CEOs of six health insurance conglomerates, Anthem, Centene, Cigna, CVS Health, Humana, and United Health Group, made a combined $236 million in 2020. That's 45% more than in 2019. Now, due to the pandemic, many executives deferred or received lower bonuses, which are mostly based on financial metrics like revenue and adjusted profits. But that didn't stop all of the cash incentives. The pandemic bonus for Mark Casper of Thermo Fisher, who told Wall Street analysts last year, it's exciting to be able to set a new bar in performance, right? Well, his almost doubled over the year to $7.8 million. Glenn Tolman cashed in more than $500 million when Teladoc bought out Livongo. And Tassos Giannakakos of Myocardia took home $239 million after his company was bought up by Bristol-Myers Squibb. Last but not least, Craig Wheeler made $85 million when Johnson & Johnson closed its deal for Fomenta Pharmaceuticals. Again, it's good to be king. Now, I beg your pardon on this this next quick segment. I forgot to ask Melody when I talked to her before the program what we're selling our Type 2 1-ounce American Gold Eagles for. I don't know if you know the answer to that, Mary Ellen. But
I wish I did.
No worries. I will say we you may be aware that the U.S. Mint is releasing a new reverse side.
Absolutely.
Of the American Gold Eagle in early July. We expect shipment by mid-July, and we're offering an introductory sale price while our supplies last. That just not much over spot whatsoever. Sort of an insult to our own balance sheet when you consider the premiums that are being charged by most of our competitors. So roundabout way of saying, if you're interested in these American Gold Eagles, they're 1-ounce coins. I think it's got a $50 face value. Please call Melody or Mary Ellen at 1-800-375-4188. Now, that does segue into our next topic. Gold sales up 360% in May, Mary Ellen?
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah? You weren't aware of that either?
Well, we're talking about the Gold Eagles. During May,
yeah.
The U.S. Mint sold 20,500 ounces of gold American Eagles, versus only 11,500 ounces in May of 2020. Is that what you're thinking about?
Yeah.
American that's Buffalo gold coins were even more popular, with 44,000 1-ounce gold coins sold in May to 2021 versus the 2,500 ounces in May of 2020. Despite the huge surge in gold sales during last March with the advent of COVID, gold bullion coin sales at the U.S. Mint through the first 5 months of 2021 was 40% larger. Remember, the U.S. Mint also limited sales recently as they prepared for the July launch of the Type 2 Gold and Silver Eagles. There's great interest in this year's American Eagle series, as there will be design change on the reverse side coming this July, the first design change since the series debuted 35 years ago in 1986. There will also be a significant debut of a special series of Morgan and Peace silver dollars to honor the centennial of the two series' transition in 1921. The first Morgan dollar mint year and the first Peace Dollar mint year. These series will also debut this fall, making 2021 a year of transition. We continue to see steep premiums on American Eagles due to delays in deliveries, limited U.S. mint sales, and high demand.
Yes, but again, for a special time, an introductory offer, you can get your American Gold Eagles from Discount Gold and Silver Trading at a very special discounted price. Just call us again at 1-800-375-4188. Now, in transition years like this, which, as Mary Ellen mentioned, don't happen very often, high premiums are usually to be expected as collectors and investors seek key dates like these years where mintages can be divided between two design types. And of course, gold's rise has been affected by the dollar. Despite a short, sharp rally late last week, the U.S. dollar index is down 3.5% since the end of March this year, and it's down almost 12% since the pandemic began last March. Of course, that's the same time that the Fed and Congress began authorizing trillions of new dollars in massive relief and stimulus spending. The tremendous expansion of the U.S. money supply over the past year has resulted in the devaluation of the dollar and a corresponding rise in commodities. And even though other currencies are being devalued through monetary expansion, the U.S. dollar's overprinting has been expanding faster, so the dollar is falling relative to other currencies. And since February last year, the U.S. monetary base, basically the currency available to spend, has shot up a whopping 75%. That's a rise unprecedented in American history, skyrocketing from $3.4 trillion last year to $6.1 trillion as of May 25th. Astounding. Excuse me. Before the 2008 financial crisis, the monetary base was just $840 billion. So it's up 620% in just 13 years after rising slowly for the previous several decades. The Treasury and the Fed's total lack of restraint when it comes to printing money has doomed the dollar to further inflation and value depreciation. It's good signs for gold and silver, ladies and gentlemen. If they're not a part of your portfolio or just a small piece, I'd seriously consider increasing them today. What's next, Mary Ellen?
The U.S. and the EU extended our tariff truce and for another 5 years, parking a dispute over aircraft subsidies given to Airbus and Boeing that saw the Allies impose duties on $11.5 billion of each other's exports. The U.S. Trade Representative Catherine Tai said the tariffs would remain suspended as long as the terms of the agreement are upheld, and while they work on addressing issues such as the outstanding subsidies already paid. The accord turns the page on a key conflict in Donald Trump's trade war and sets the stage for a new era of transatlantic cooperation over state aid at a time when China is vying to displace the Boeing Airbus civil aircraft duopoly. The European Commission spent last night discussing the accord with member states to get the deal over the line before an EU-US summit in Brussels with President Biden. The Allies will also vow to end a separate dispute over steel and aluminum in a sign of progress in resetting the relationship. Under the Airbus-Boeing deal, all future passenger aircraft will be required to be developed without subsidies. The agreement was driven in part by a growing awareness among policymakers in Brussels and Washington that China's state-sponsored aerospace manufacturer, Commercial Aircraft Corp of China, COMAC, is on track to become a legitimate rival in global plane making by the end of the decade. How about that?
How about that? China pulling out all stops, it seems. I always wondered why there were really just two primary manufacturers of airplanes, but here you go, another way that China is trying to become the number one economy by the end of the decade. But this deal with the EU and the U.S. is significant. I mean, this aircraft feud dates back to 2004 when the U.S. lodged a legal case at the WTO against the EU over member state support for Airbus or to Airbus for commercial aircraft development. A parallel case opened by the EU argued that Boeing benefited from U.S. subsidies as well as space and military contracts, which defrayed the cost of civilian aircraft development. Just 2 years ago, the WTO authorized the U.S. to level tariffs against $7.5 billion of EU imports every year over government support for Airbus. The EU then won permission to hit back with levies on $4 billion of U.S. air goods. It's always tit for tat, Mary Ellen. Certainly consumers don't win, whether the end user is a business or folks like you and me. While the dispute escalated during the last administration, the levies, which extend beyond aircraft parts to things like tractors, wine and cheese, they were both suspended by the parties in March as negotiators worked toward an agreement. The UK unilaterally suspended its tariffs with the US in December, as it broke from the EU back then. The EU and U.S. will also commit at the summit to remove tariffs related to a steel and aluminum dispute, at least according to a draft of that meeting. In 2018, you may recall, the U.S. imposed levies on metal exports from Europe on national security grounds. Well, we have about a minute, perhaps less. We'll start this next one after we come back, because that minute went by oh so quickly. You're listening to Financial Survival. Stick around for these few important messages, and we'll be back then.
Since the beginning of the United States, kings have sought it, nations have fought for it. It has been traded, borrowed, purchased, and stolen. There is a reason for it. To secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity, invest with the security of gold and silver. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading at 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Listen to Financial Survival with your host, Melody Cederstrom, on Shortwave Radio. Visit DiscountGoldAndSilverTrading.net or call 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. For the very best in gold and silver trading, call toll-free 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Call now.
Melody Cederstrom and CSE Talk Radio team up as Common Sense Voices of Integrity. I personally endorse Melody Cederstrom to be your trusted go-to expert for all your precious metal needs. Experts agree a financial crisis and even collapse is inevitable. Given our government's lack of economic leadership and self-interests of those in power, it's no longer a question of if you should purchase gold and silver, but if you will purchase gold and silver before it's too late. Melody encourages you to tune in each weekday morning. Visit CSE Talk Radio. TimUpRadio.com. We both agree truth and education are the two significant factors in both our missions. There is a wealth of misinformation out there. Let Melody and Beth Ann help you sort through the chaos and bring you home to the truths that will ensure that you and your family are protected. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading, 1-800-375-4188, or online at DGScoins.com. Melody and Beth Ann are strong forces together, working to preserve liberty and bring America home.
Hey, one last time today. Welcome back to Financial Survival. I'm Dave Allen. Melody has the day off. Thanks again to our good friend Mary Ellen for sitting in the first two segments. Going to start this final segment just to follow up on China and trade. The world's second largest economy hit back at Joe Biden's efforts to build a new coalition to counter Beijing. A Chinese foreign ministry spokesperson said the U.S. is ill, very ill indeed, as he responded to Biden's diplomatic efforts at the G7 and NATO meetings this week. I imagine that the word ill is a function of a quirky translation in the language. When it comes to China, nothing is black or white anymore. The Group of Seven summit in the UK, followed by today's NATO meeting in Brussels, and the EU-US talks tomorrow will be one giant reminder of that. At each stop, Biden and other world leaders have been and will be wrestling with the question of how to balance ties with Beijing. The mantra from the G7, repeating throughout, cooperate with China on areas of common interest, compete economically, and challenge it on issues like human rights in places like Xinjiang. That's multiple goals for an already very complicated relationship, but as we saw at the English seaside at the weekend, countries differ on what exactly that means to both compete and cooperate with China. Much depends on their individual economic imperative. Some are hesitant, on the other hand, about being seen as part of an anti-China bloc. Certainly a lot more of this discussion in the coming weeks, months, and years. We'll be here to talk about it with you. Now, our latest American Survival newsletter has hit the streets. You can sign up for our free weekly newsletters and blogs at dgscoins.com. dgscoins.com. I have an article in today's edition called If You Think Education is Expensive, Try Ignorance. Certainly not my term. In fact, first time I heard it was in, I think, 1980. While serving as an intern with the union that represented the state college faculty in Pennsylvania, which is actually a part of the topic of my article. Let me tell you more. In general, flying below the radar across the country under the shadow of the better-known student loan crisis, colleges and universities in America have been having trouble paying their bills. There's a reckoning coming in higher ed, especially for smaller private liberal arts schools. It's actually been years in the making. No doubt, COVID accelerated some of these trends and revealed what I think is an existential nature of the companion crisis. The college finances have been hurting for quite some time. Pandemic government stimulus funds have helped a number of struggling schools gain another year or two of financial maneuvering, but their restructuring advisors say there's been an uptick in schools that are beginning to explore financial alternatives to keep them from going under. Declining birth rates mean the pool of college-age Americans has been declining, and it could be as much as 15% lower by the mid-2020s compared with the early 2000s, according to some. As Axios's Kate Marino says, demographics are destiny. Smaller suburban and rural liberal arts schools are taking the brunt of this shrinking student body. The effect is much more profound than felt, certainly, by the elite universities with huge endowments or larger state schools that receive public funding. Matthew Roseman, who runs the bankruptcy practice at Cullen Dykeman, says these schools, amid intense competition, wind up offering substantial tuition discounts to a large chunk of students. They're also often entirely tuition dependent with virtually no endowments. Well, then, drum roll please. Yes, COVID hit. Schools lost much or all of their room and board revenue since last spring semester, and some of that may never return to prior levels, especially as remote learning strategies expand and in some places become permanent. And now Marino warns this fall's enrollment numbers will be make or break for many. But colleges can't file for Chapter 11 bankruptcy, can they? Certainly not the way insolvent companies can, because they'd lose their accreditation, as well as student access to federal grants and loans. And banks and other lenders that provide loans to colleges are usually willing to provide more flexibility than they would to corporate borrowers, with things like maturity extensions and other types of relief. Mark Pogeny, who's managing director at consulting firm Getzler Henrich, says bank directors are reputation sensitive and no one wants to read headlines about stopping a kid's education in its tracks. But in return, lenders usually require universities to shore up their balance sheets through mortgages or by selling real estate or by inking an M&A or cost-sharing thing with another school. If a school still can't survive, the insolvency process it uses is called a teach-out. I've heard of teach-ins, but a teach-out. That's where another school takes over its facilities and offers classes to students while the legacy school liquidates its assets. Higher Ed Dive, it's the name of an organization that's cataloged recent transactions in higher ed, finding at least 18 schools closed or were consolidated into another institution before the pandemic in 2019 during in 2020, after 25 such deals in the prior 2 years. Now, help could be around the corner for struggling schools and students in Connecticut if a recent three-way deal centered around the University of Bridgeport goes as planned. We've learned that Goodwin acquired the University of Bridgeport's real estate and academic programs. At the same time, Payer College of Art will relocate to Bridgeport's campus and share resources there. The three will remain independent institutions. Perhaps most important, this dilemma and its impact aren't limited to private schools. In fact, here in my home state, the Pennsylvania State System of Higher Education is considering two consolidation plans for six of its 14 public universities. I'm looking at the acronym PSSHE. We're going to say PISHE. PISHE has struggled with declining enrollments and stagnant state funding for years. And the pandemic pushed the system to hasten its plan for financial sustainability. Education appropriations from the state legislature per full-time equivalent student have decreased decreased by 52% since 2001, falling from a little over 8,700 back then to 4,100 in 2019. Excuse me, I must take a sip of water. One plan, dubbed the West Integration Plan, will consolidate California, Clarion, and Edinburgh universities, which are all located in the western part of the state. The Northeast Integration Plan will consolidate Bloomsburg, Lock Haven, and Mansfield universities, which are clustered in the northeastern and north central part of the state. Oh, gosh, the coughing has gotten worse here. The consolidated universities will have a shared enrollment strategy and student support services such as academic advising, financial aid, health and wellness counseling, library services, and, yes, career counseling. The two plans don't say how the consolidation efforts will affect employees. At the West Consolidated University, enrollment's expected to increase by 2% annually. System officials say if those projections are right, they expect that the Consolidated University will maintain its faculty levels and may even hire more instructors as part of its online offerings. At the Northeast Consolidated University, enrollment's expected to increase by 1% per year. But overall, they say the number of staff members employed by each consolidated university is likely to change, i.e. shrink. Both plans said periodic adjustments to personnel may be required to meet institutional needs. That's a hint, ladies and gentlemen. Notably, the plan also aims to reduce the cost, the total cost of degree attainment by 25% per student. In-state tuition at these six institutions currently falls in a range between roughly $7,800 and $11,200 a year. Certainly a bargain when compared to larger state universities and certainly private schools. System officials say the two consolidated universities will be given a new name sometime this summer. At that point, Pennsylvania's system of 14 state-owned colleges, universities, will be drawn down to 10. Most students don't consider a school's ability to pay its bill when choosing a college. Yeah, great business school, but wow, have you seen their liabilities? Don't remember that dialogue, ladies and gentlemen. But they're the ones who stand to lose the most from closures. The earlier that schools, both public and private, acknowledge and come up with a plan to deal with problems like these, the more likely they'll be able to create a path for students to start their studies and actually earn their degrees. Otherwise, we all just might find that ignorance is even more expensive than education. Thanks for bearing with my post-laryngitis comeback during that story. I just want to spend a minute here on this interesting thought that I saw in this article today. It asks, are price increases caused by poor infrastructure? The context of rising inflation, increasing consumer demand, coupled, with the supply chain log jams, and also about the Washington debate over an infrastructure bill. And there are some areas of the economy where it looks like supply chain tensions and bottlenecks and shortages are starting to ease just a bit. Housing is one of those areas. Lumber just had its biggest ever weekly decline in price recently. But in some crucial areas, like global freight, well, they're still getting worse. I mean, take the Freightos Index used to gauge the cost of shipping goods from China to the U.S. West Coast. It started taking off like a rocket last summer and hasn't slowed down since. Now, there are numerous reasons for the surge in shipping costs, but one contributor to all the problems in logistics right now is shoddy or out-of-date infrastructure. Yes, another I word, infrastructure. On a recent podcast, the guest, who was a former big container ship worker, said he saw a crack. I saw a crack. It was a crack. You could see daylight through. It was kind of massive. Nothing fell into the river, but either way, I wouldn't want to be on a tugboat under it. Put it that way. He continued, so the ports in the U.S. haven't kept up with the increasing ship size at all. This creates longer unload times for the ships, which causes delays, slower turnaround times, and so forth. And then on top of that, our internal waterways are crumbling, further impeding the flow of goods domestically. Pardon me. One of the things I think about is how our entire concept of paying for it, if you will, is totally off. I mean, if we do some really big infrastructure project, I don't mean an infrastructure bill costing $1 or $2 trillion. I mean one big project. People imagine that we either have to pay for it now with taxes, or our children will have to pay for it one day down the road. And in some respects, that's the case. Say when it comes to, say, building a new elementary or high school. It's one of the reasons school districts and counties issue bonds to pay for that, because they assume, well, it's got to have a useful life of 20, 30, 40 years, maybe more. So why shouldn't the cost of that be spread out over that time? Well, in reality, isn't really the opposite what we're paying for right now in the form of higher prices on various goods is in part, maybe even in large part, the lack of investment in key infrastructure in the years and decades leading up to the crisis today. Think about it. Let us know what you think. Send us your thoughts to discountgoldandsilver@yahoo.com. We'll share them on a future program of Financial Survival. Hey, that's the end of today's program, ladies and gentlemen. Thanks again to Mary Ellen for sitting in. I'm Dave Allen. I'll be back tomorrow. Wendy Wilson of Apothecary Curbs. Until then, have a good evening, and please be safe out there. Bye-bye.